This is CliffCentral.com.
Oh, well, I mean, that's powerful, huh? That is just powerful stuff. Ray Phiri with Stimela and Zwagala. Mabs was saying that she remembers that song from, like, nights her parents would have people around and...
I mean, it was, you know, it was always part of the playlist where my parents were involved. As soon as the good times start rolling, there's bound to be a Ray Phiri song in there with all the adults, like, kind of like letting the liquor sink in.
Mm. You remember it from what show?
Zone 14 on SABC 1 was like part of the title sequence. So I didn't even know it was a Ray Phiri song up until a few years ago.
Well, I'll tell you what, we'll repost the interview I did with Ray Phiri last year, where we spoke about a lot of really interesting aspects of the whole music business and his career so far, his thoughts about how music was changing. We had a very open discussion about a lot of things that mattered to him. And I can't believe we were talking about him just yesterday with Machaka.
Mm.
We were saying he's not well. People were commenting on that. And then one day later, we get this news. It's my great pleasure to have Charles Ngakula, who is joining us. He is a stalwart of not only all the revolutionary movements in South Africa, the UDF, the SACP, the ANC. He's been a minister. He's written a new book, which we're going to discuss with him this morning. And it's my absolute pleasure to welcome him to our studio on CliffCentral.com on this Wednesday morning. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning, and thank you very much for inviting me.
It's an absolute pleasure to have you here. You've been such an important part of our political landscape for such a long time, you and your wife. And the contributions you've made have been extraordinary as minister, as someone in the SACP of huge consequence, the General Secretary for many years, and even back all the way to the UDF, and your journalism, which started you off on this journey.
Hmm.
So it's great to see a book that's now here for us to read.
In fact, what I want to do is to give a copy to you.
Thank you so much.
It is autographed.
Thank you so much. Charles, it's a pleasure to see you. Am I meant to refer to you as a minister, even though you're an ex-minister?
No, refer to me as Charles.
No, thank you. Because I don't even know where to start. Writing for you was obviously the beginning.
Correct.
And reading and writing for you was your way into the liberation movement.
That's correct.
And if you think about great people who came before you, you know, the Steve Bikos and the people who said that they write what they like and that writing is so important. Is that what inspired you to get involved? Is that how you became involved in the movement of the people, the People's War, the title of your book?
Well, I joined the African National Congress in 1959 as a member of the ANC Youth League.
You look very young.
Well,
for a man who's had such a long history.
On the 13th of September this year, I'm going to be 75 years old.
Wow.
And you began covering political news in 1966 or so?
Yes.
Is that about right?
That's correct, yes.
And you did that for many years, for almost 20 years.
Oh, yes. Until, of course, I was banned and I could no longer write, at least for publication.
Now, you also had to then leave the country in exile in 1984. Had you already become an active member of various parts of the ANC by then, so that you were not only known and had to leave the country, to go into exile like so many of our political stalwarts, or was your involvement covert at that point?
Well, it had to be covert. I mean, we had been doing a lot of ANC work underground for many years after the ANC was banned. And it got to a stage where the ANC instructed me to put together a propaganda unit, so to speak, but underground. And we did a lot of work as part of that unit.
What was it like being in the ANC in those years? Because we know a lot about the period where, you know, there was an armed struggle. We know a lot about the period where the ANC was banned and there were certain people who, outside of the country, were running operations. You know, luminaries. These are people like O.R. Tambo, people like Walter Sisulu, members of the government that are currently serving in South Africa, and people who had gone into exile to study, to learn as much as they could so that they could lead when eventually, and of course at that stage it was only a dream, when eventually South Africa would become liberated. What was the ANC like at that point?
Firstly, I want to quote for you what Steve Chwete used to say. I worked with him underground. And Steve Chwete used to say that, you see, some people like to say politics is a game. And politics is not a game. It is a matter of life and death. And he would say we must be very, very careful that we are not arrested as we do our work. Of course, we would be now and again detained. But he was insisting that if indeed you are detained, you must not have any incriminating evidence in your hands. Otherwise, he would say, you are going to die because the enemy of our revolution would like to eliminate as many of us as possible. Therefore, be safe all the time. That indicates how big a problem this was. In fact, you know, to respond to the other aspect of your question, when I arrived in exile, I was one day invited by our former president, Thabo Mbeki, and we had, you know, a long discussion. His intention, given the work that I had already been doing inside the country for the ANC's propaganda machinery, he wanted me to be part of his unit, because his unit was dealing with propaganda and information. He wanted me to be part of that. And of course, I wanted to become a soldier so that I could get back into the country and fight for the liberation of our country.
Were there choices that you had to make personally that involved your own personal safety before you had gone into exile and even after?
Well, this is what we had to do. In fact, at a later stage, we were even trained on how to remain safe all the time within the context of the prosecution of our struggle.
Can you tell us some of those stories that you outline in the book? Some of the stories of what exactly it meant in terms of personal sacrifices, the relationships that you had, the people that you spent time with, because you could put them in direct danger if you yourself were arrested and they were in your company. There were people that you had written letters to. I mean, you know, it wasn't the age of the internet, so there were ways and means that you could disguise things, but you were always at risk.
No, that is true. In fact, you know, the family that, and I want to use here the terminology of the racist regime, who harbored me when I came inside the country, of course, a family that I had already met in Zimbabwe, were people that I really wanted to ensure were safe all the time. One of the things we did was to produce a letter, which in a sense was responding to an advert that I had placed in the newspapers, indicating that I was a student and I needed accommodation in Cape Town. Then they wrote back to say that they do have accommodation, but for a short period of time. They were leaving and they wanted someone to look after their house. Now, that was intended, you know, for any eventuality leading to my arrest, so that at least they would be safe. They would say they did not know me. They got me into their house simply because they wanted me to look after their house. And of course, at one stage, I decided to leave them and simply use their house as a safe haven, so to speak. In the event something would happen to me, I would quickly go to that house for preparation to get out of Cape Town, where I was based. And of course, that house, also a portion of that house, we used to hide my military wear, rifles, pistols, grenades.
Your wife, the two of you, this was a relationship that grew out of what you both believed and where you both entered the liberation movement and so much of it you shared together. on your journey. How did you two meet?
Well, for starters, I only met in 1982. Mm-hmm. And I had gone to a place that we were using for our meetings in East London, and in the central business district in East London. At a time, actually, when I was banned, and not just after the banning order was withdrawn, I was then declared a prohibited immigrant. For me to be in East London, therefore, I needed travel documents, I would have to have a visa, and so on. But I occasionally went to that place for meetings. And then on this day, one day, I saw her with a number of people that I knew. I had not ever seen her before that. And in the end, we started discussions with her. And I discovered that, she was using the phraseology that is was common at the time between ANC underground workers. And her views coincided with my own views. And we started the political relationship first. And, of course, in the circumstances, we then became lovers.
It's a beautiful story in the midst of all of the much more intellectual and political and struggle relations that were going on. Because, obviously, for two people who shared these views, you sometimes had to choose between each other's safety and the movement or the ideology or the fight or the struggle itself, where you faced very real dangers. I mean, were there ever points where you sat down and the two of you said, well, for the purposes of, the next few weeks or some operations that we had undertaken together, it would be better for us to be apart?
Oh, yes, we did that. One time, we picked up information that the security police were looking for her. We had to move her from East London, where she lived, to Zwelitsha, underground at her friend's house for the duration, to ensure that there would be no further searches for her. And of course, before we left the country again, the police were looking for her. And we discovered that someone, she had been, of course, a guerrilla, she had been working with, had been arrested. And a person she had recruited and introduced to that guerrilla was also arrested. She had to leave East London again to go to Butterworth. And then someone I was working with was also arrested. And he sent us a message to say that it is time for you to vanish. Wow. Because I am being tortured here, which meant that, look, I'll break. So get out of the area. That's when we decided to go into exile.
Gets a little close for comfort. And you realize that it's, you actually have to run away.
Correct. In fact, firstly, there is someone we're working with. You know, we were a grouping of comrades who were put together for purposes of ensuring that we would be able in our region to drive the revolution. Steve Chwete was part of that, Makengese Stofile, someone we called Sticks, Bangumzi Sifingo, and myself. And now and again, of course, we would bring in other people for purposes of discharging certain obligations. But that four was the main grouping. And then Sifingo, he was working for Chloride at the battery factory. And the police went to that factory looking for him. He was bearded like me during those days, full beard.
I liked your mugshot, by the way.
Thank you very much. Then the workers went back. He had fortunately not left his office yet. They went back and said, the police are here and they are looking for you. They shaved off his hair and his beard. They gave him, workers' overalls and a cap. So he went past the police into a car which was organized outside by the workers, and he was able to get out of the area. Of course, we took him to Ellis, to Fort Hare, where Stofile was a lecturer. And we asked Stofile to ensure that he was hidden. The following day, of course, we went back to Fort Hare. We took him to an isolated area. And we said, if you are arrested, we will also be arrested. So we'll have to get you out of the country. Stofile, in fact, on that day said, look, when the sun comes up tomorrow, you must be gone. And I argued that, look, let's allow him to quickly organize his things. And when we left for exile, we found him in Lesotho.
These stories are such an important part of our history, and some of them are not well known, and that's why it's so important that you've written this book. But were there places that were safer than others? I mean, where did you feel safe? Because everywhere around you, you weren't sure whether the police would arrive, how much information they had, what they'd intercepted, who had told them something that they might not have known was incriminating or dangerous to you. Were there places where you felt safe?
No, you wouldn't. Even when we were in Lusaka, you couldn't feel safe there. So now and again, we would be told by our intelligence that there was a serious alert. The serious alert meant that agents of the system had come into Lusaka. And they would either poison. There is a story I tell there of someone who was poisoned. Mm. And they were always, you know, around all these places where we were. And then in 1986, May that year, they came in, you know, with jets and dropped some bombs in Lusaka and almost hit two places which were important to us. Firstly, our crash, and of course, Tabumbeki's a Department of Information offices. Now, you were never safe anywhere where you were. I mean, look at, for instance, the attacks in London, attacks in Paris. So we were never safe. Lesotho was worse, of course, which is where we entered exile. It was worse. I mean, like when in 1985, the racist regime came in and helped the soldiers in Lesotho to topple Jonathan's government, and Jonathan's government was very warm towards us. Mm. And I mean, they were there moving, you know, with gay abandon right through Lesotho, particularly in Maseru.
Yeah, almost as if it was part of South Africa.
As if it was part
no
of
sovereignty.
South Africa. Of course, yes.
You obviously had close relations with those people you've just mentioned, Makengetsi Stofile and others, but you were quite close to Thabo Mbeki, and you had a lot of work that the two of you did together.
Yes.
Are you still in regular communication?
I'm not in regular communication. You see, the funny thing with me is that I wanted only my work to speak for me.
Uh-huh.
I did not want friendships to speak for me. And despite the fact that we were doing a lot of work, he was a comrade to me and not a friend. He was a comrade.
Are most of your friends not political friends? They're not friends who you worked with?
Well, some of them are political friends. You know, we lead the kind of life that we like, having have had a lot of experience of underground work. My real comrade and friend is my wife.
Yes.
So when we knock off work, we go home. We don't socialize. We go back home.
Your wife couldn't be here this morning. I believe her father's very ill.
Very, very ill.
Sorry.
He's in the last stages of cancer.
I'm very sorry to hear that. And you would have heard the news this morning about Ray Phiri.
Yes.
Very, very sad.
Yes, yes. And, you know, my father-in-law, I mean, the cancer has permeated every bone in his body.
Very sorry.
And all that we are doing is to manage, you know, his pain. Otherwise, of course, he's old also. He's 96 years old.
And of course, your wife is still serving as a minister and a very important minister at that. She's the Minister of Defense.
Correct.
Does she bring home files that she doesn't allow you to look at? Or are you too fair? No. Are you trusted too if she discusses something with you? It's okay. I mean, military stuff is it tends to be the most high level secret stuff. And even though you've been the chair of the portfolio on intelligence and many other things that are very, very sensitive, are there things that she doesn't necessarily have to run by you or let you see?
Well, as I say, we still have this thing of our training in underground work. And, you know, we used to have a slogan, and we still go by that slogan, that you don't ask questions of things you are not supposed to know. So I never ask her about her job. What is interesting, of course, is the fact that there are at least two portfolios where I served and where she eventually was appointed into. For instance, I was appointed Deputy Minister of Home Affairs in 1991. And then Steve Chwede died, who was the Minister of Police in 1992. So I was appointed Minister of Police. And she was appointed Deputy of Home Affairs, where I used to work. And I also was appointed Minister of Defense. And of course, Lindiwe Sisulu became the minister after me. But after Lindiwe, she was appointed, yes. But we never asked one about one's work. Of course, when you come back from work, you will say that, hey, I had a difficult day. And at times you would say, there are people, man, who are annoying me. That's all. Not the secrets of the department where you work.
What sort of work was, changing portfolios like that, and we often see people are deployed to different cabinet positions and people have very important roles to play in the movement. And sometimes it's difficult for people to understand how you can swap a portfolio like Home Affairs as Deputy Minister to one of police, where it's very different. The kind of work, the sort of people who report to you, the Directors General who you're responsible for, and the political ideas that need to inform your decisions then. As the political head of that department, is it very difficult to change hands and to go from Home Affairs to police to defense?
Nosviwe and I have been quite fortunate with regards to that, because Home Affairs is a security department. Mm. The police security, defense security, and correctional services security. So we've never been appointed outside of the security cluster. And because that cluster meets regularly, you would understand what is happening in other departments. So when you go there, you are prepared, so to speak, in order for you to deliver the service which is required.
I can't imagine a more important cluster, actually, in government. It must be the one that you don't miss meetings for.
Well,
things go horribly wrong if someone misses those meetings.
Yes. During the apartheid years, those departments are the ones that were getting more money, because they were responsible also for the protection of the system of apartheid. So they are very important. I mean, if you look at Home Affairs, I know that people just consider the fact that you go there and you get what is called civil service matters. In other words, your birth certificate, your marriage certificate, and your death certificate.
But these are things that touch the citizens of this country citizens more than almost anything else. Right.
But it's not all that you do there. And one of the most important is the fact that you produce not just the legalizing documents, but things like the currency of the country. It's printed there, and other things relating to the security of the country.
How do you think South Africa's security apparatus changed from when you were first in the cabinet all the way back in 1991 right through to when you eventually left the cabinet a few years ago? How much changed? How much did you see changing during the different administrations and from just after apartheid right the way through?
Well, there is not adequate interest these days by young people in departments, for instance, like intelligence, the police. Defense is better because there are many young people who are being recruited and who want to be part of the South African National Defense Force. But in those two areas, there are difficulties. The consequence is we have lost a lot of experience in those departments. Therefore, the intelligence is not on a basis that is equal to when I was in government, for instance. And this is the same with respect, you know, to the police. You no longer have that experience, which in the main was dictated to by the availability of people who had been trained either in Umkhonto Wesizwe, where the PAC armed wing and the Azapo armed wing. Now you no longer find those people.
You must have been very involved in the setting up of our intelligence agencies, because you were in that security cluster when they were first promulgated as legislative requirements for a South African state apparatus, but also in the appointment of important people to important roles in those intelligence agencies, and later on as portfolio head of that committee. It must have been a keen interest of yours to make sure that all of that worked well and that we had the right people in the right places.
Well, I did not directly participate in the putting together of those structures, because that was done by units within the process of negotiations who were participating directly in the negotiations process. Because I was general secretary of the party, I did not become part of the actual foot soldiers who were putting all of this together. But I was a member of the ANC's National Executive Committee. All of these things were reported to that structure, and we would therefore make various inputs to ensure that what we would in the end get would be to the best purposes of ensuring that we were bringing our country together, by ensuring that everybody who was in these negotiations in the end would be happy with what we were designing, you know, going into the future. Then, as I say, we had human resources that we easily deployed. And when, for instance, we were putting together the layer of leadership in the administration of the various departments, it is people that we knew, and it was easier those times to therefore put them into the positions that they occupied. And in the beginning, they worked very, very well because they had that kind of experience. It is later that as people were leaving those positions, going into retirement and so on, we were not getting people who were even better than the ones who left. The experience was not the same.
Well, this is probably an appropriate time to ask you a question about your generation of stalwarts in the movement, because there are two schools of thought. There are those people who want you to keep working and keep fighting and keep representing all your life long, and you can never retire, and to the grave you must be someone who is at the forefront. And then there are those people who say, well, actually, you deserve to have a life after politics, and you deserve to have a life after dedicating most of your adult life to the movement. How do you feel about that? Because there are few of your generation left in active government service and an active ANC service at the moment.
Except that we don't have a life outside of politics.
You really don't?
We don't. I mean, the only thing you know is politics. There's nothing else that you know. But personally, and I said this even at the policy conference, I think I have a lot of experience in terms of understanding the politics of our revolution.
Yes.
And I indicated to them that, well, I mean, I'm not in the in the queue for any political position. But the one thing I know,
which almost gives you it gives you a role almost above the positions and the appointments, where you're able to articulate your position and your thoughts on things in a much more independent fashion.
Yes, and of course I said that the one thing that I believe the African National Congress ought to use me for is political education. And political education I can do at any stage. The other day, I was in the Eastern Cape, and when I entered the hall where we were going to start, you know, a consultative conference, I met at the door by the leader of the ANC in that province, and he said to me, look, we would like you to talk to us about the Morogoro conference. And I said, no, okay. Because, I mean, I don't need to
political history
and study anything. I know
it. You were there.
And I said, listen, no, I was not at Morogoro.
You weren't.
I was at Kabwe.
Kabwe, sorry. Yeah.
And I said to them, it will not only be Morogoro. I need to go and talk about Kabwe as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I delivered my lecture on the day, because I know those things. And I was appealing that, look, I still want to be involved politically, but only in that way, which I can do for as long as I'm able to speak, until I'm gone.
When it comes to political education, though, you have to take the long view, and your book does. It goes back to when you had first entered the movement, but even before then, and where we're at the moment. And a lot of people are saying that the ANC is going through some difficulties now. In fact, that was one of the things that was admitted at the conference by almost all the delegates. There are problems. You know, your organization matures, it changes. Sometimes there are fractures and fissures and areas where there are going to be conflicts between certain personalities and factions within a movement. How do you feel that the ANC is faring at the moment?
Well, the ANC is really going through a very, very bad patch. I don't remember the ANC being in a situation like this before. Which brings me to this aspect of the refusal of our leadership to convene a consultative conference. I spoke about this at the conference, at the policy conference, and I said, I am sad that the leadership, not only has not been able to convene a consultative conference, but the fact that the president himself spoke so disparagingly about the stalwarts and veterans who had been agitating for a consultative conference. My departure point was, on the 8th of January this year, at the celebration of the ANC's 105th year, the ANC NEC, through the president, raised the Morogoro Consultative Conference, where there were big problems before it was convened for the ANC. And there were people who were raising those problems, including Chris Hani, who had submitted a memorandum. It has gone into the annals of our history as the Chris Hani memorandum, raising some of those difficulties. But they were not the only ones who were raising problems. There are others who were raising problems. And people like Ben Turok also raised problems about what was happening in the ANC at the time. And Oliver Tambo, as president of the ANC, of course at that time he was called acting president of the ANC, decided to convene the Morogoro conference.
So we have a blueprint from history.
We have a blueprint because our leadership on the 8th of January this year then said, After the Morogoro conference, the ANC emerged united. In other words, they needed to sit as leaders of the ANC and discuss the problems of the ANC openly in order for them to arrive at a situation where, you know, they could put together for the first time. The ANC penned what is now called a strategy and tactics document. Now, then came Kabwe. And the Kabwe Consultative Conference had to be convened because at that time, this was 1985, our people inside the country were on the boil. In fact, they were breathing, you know, right down the enemy's neck. And in many areas in the country, our people had actually established people's structures. And the structures that the regime was imposing on our people became completely non-functional. Oliver Tambo had said, make South Africa ungovernable. And it was ungovernable. Now, when that happens, you say as a revolutionary that the revolutionary moment has arisen. And when the revolutionary moment has arisen, you can't as a revolutionary organization not act. And Kabwe, therefore, was necessary for the ANC to design a new tactic of dealing with that matter. And Tambo said, as a consequence, that the 80s must be our decade of liberation. And of course, in all intents and purposes, by the end of 1989, everything was ready except for de Klerk's signature,
right,
which happened early in February to show that things had already, you know, been done. My argument, therefore, is when the ANC is in a difficulty like it is now, you require a consultative conference of all the generations of the ANC, your stalwarts, your veterans, to the youth of the ANC.
So why has it not happened? If there's a historical blueprint for this, that historical blueprint delivered successes which brought about change and united the ANC, then why, if the ANC is to succeed and to survive, why is this not the most urgent priority?
Particularly when the Secretary General of the ANC brings what was called the diagnostic report. Because you see, if you are a doctor and you examine a patient and you come to a particular diagnosis, then you must decide what medication do I want for this. But they stopped without saying the medication we require would be for us to get together and design a response.
Some people wouldn't even admit the patient was sick.
In fact, some did not want to admit that. Fact of the matter is, whether people, as a matter of their own tactic, on the basis of the factions they belong to, even if at the public level they say we have no problems, they know there are problems. They have seen those problems in their branches, in their regions, and in their provinces. So it is untrue to say that the ANC has no problems. And some of us, and I'm going to continue to argue this, you need a consultative conference at least to ensure that the ANC is able, therefore, to correct itself, particularly because we always claim as members of the ANC that
broad church,
and we are able, you know, to self-correct.
Self-correct.
Yes.
Charles, is it frustrating you that you are that there are people in leadership who are not listening to this call, who seem to be willing to waste some of this very proud legacy, to spend political capital that has been hard earned by people like you, your wife, by people who you've known and seen die in the struggle?
This is really frustrating, very, very frustrating for me. I usually tell people that whatever little education I have was not as a consequence of me sitting on a desk at school and within the perimeters of the four walls of a classroom. Most of the things I know were as a consequence of interactions I've had with various kinds of people. When we were launching this book here in Johannesburg on the 22nd of June. A friend and a comrade of mine, by the way, who belongs to the PAC, and I belong in the ANC, asked a question because that session was interactive. He asked the following question. How do I describe my easiness on the basis of an ecumenical approach to things that I see? He says, for instance, you hobnob with people from religion, you easily interact with people from other political organizations and so on. I said, my view always has been that every person, even those who we've described as thoroughgoing criminals, have an element in their makeup. In some, it may be just a small spark, but in others, it may be quite big. And who will know right from wrong? And I say, if our desire is the same, it does not matter to me where you come from, because we have the same understanding that we have to move from where we are through a developmental program for us to be at a better place. If you accept that, then it means to me you are a comrade, because there are certain things I will learn from you which I did not know, and we go forward together. Now, someone who is like that was Oliver Tambo himself. There was a big problem in South Africa during these days, during the 80s. And whereas we were supposed to be concentrating all our energy at defeating apartheid, we still had our own little battles. And some of them, which became quite acute, were the fight between the Black Consciousness aligned groupings and the UDF. And at times, what they were fighting about was the Freedom Charter. The BAC's view to the Freedom Charter was that we had put in a clause there that defined South Africa into the ranks of prostitution. When you say South Africa belongs to all who live in it, the BAC did not like that.
What was their line on that?
Well, their line was that South Africa belongs to the indigenous people of the country, the Africans.
Right.
They were arguing. And we were saying that South Africa belongs to all who live in it, black and white. That was the ANC view. So those fights were happening, and people actually were dying as a consequence of the fights between these revolutionary units who were supposed to be focusing on the enemy of the people's revolution. Now, there was a children's conference in Harare in 1986. And, of course, there were many people who came from South Africa attending that. And, of course, many of them, in order for us to have interactions with, as underground workers. And Tambo used an analogy where he was saying, you cannot, because your own political program is advanced, not accommodate those who are still crawling, so to speak, politically. And he made the analogy of someone who was carrying baggage and going to these isolated, in the olden days, they were isolated small cubicles which were used as waiting rooms for trains that would pass in the ungodly hours of the morning. And many of them would go there during the daytime, before sunset, so to speak, to get to those places. He says, you come across someone who says, I'm going to that village down there, but can I carry part of your bags? And Ogar says, you would be stupid not to accept that offer. Because he says, as you talk with this person, whatever you are discussing may be so interesting that the person would say, look, I said I'm going here, but I want to take you a little further. And in the end, you know, they are there together with you at this station waiting for the train because of the interest your discussions are raising. And therefore, we said, don't use the Freedom Charter, he said as he was talking to our people. Don't use the Freedom Charter. Simply use the fact that we are in a revolution to defeat apartheid. That is all. It's a minimum program like that. Communist Party, by the way, you have referred to, also went into alliance with the ANC on the ANC's minimum program of the National Democratic Revolution. But the Communist Party's own program is socialism. It goes beyond just National Democratic Revolution.
Well, you raised the South African Communist Party. You were General Secretary. You took over from Chris Hani at a time where it must have been very fractious, where there must have been very emotive discussions around the future of that movement, around their part in the total liberation movement, their accessibility to positions and structures and authority within the rest of the alliance. How do you feel the SACP in its current incarnation is faring?
The SACP, fortunately, has not been in the same space as the ANC. It is relatively together. And after, during the time when Chris Hani was the General Secretary, the alliance itself was formidable. And each component part of the alliance also was doing well. The SACP was doing well, and so was COSATU. Mm. Now, these were the period just before the election, and then after the election, I was the General Secretary of the party. I inherited, therefore, that type of
strength
of this party. Yeah. And we discussed everything. We had meetings with the ANC where we raised a number of things. In fact, in the book also, I talk about our relationship with Nelson Mandela and some of the things that we pushed as the party. Today, Saharawi, has been officially accepted by South Africa, and therefore we have ambassadorial changes. Mm. The issue of Indonesia, we also, as the party, spoke with Madiba, and the issues there were resolved. The matter of the two Chinas, also that policy mm-hmm. was resolved as well. In other words, we still had that kind of image with respect to the broader alliance of our people. The Communist Party at this stage, I believe, is continuing on the same path. The difference, though, which I want to bring out, is the fact that during our times, the membership of the Communist Party in the main was the working class. Now it is people, students, for instance, have become members of the Communist Party, and others who are not the working class. But with regards to the working class also, I do wish to point out the fact that the public unions have suddenly become the bigger unions in COSATU. Whereas what you actually want is for, you know, the actual workers' unions to be in charge. NUMSA has gone. Mm-hmm. And it was expelled by COSATU, and it had together with the National Union of Mine Workers, were the biggest component, and therefore were the organizations that were in the leadership structures of COSATU. Today, it is the public sector unions which do not have the same zeal as your real working class unions. The party, therefore, is drawing from those unions in the main, and not your actual workers' unions.
There's so much I want to talk to you about. It almost feels like we need to sit here for 3 hours. But you've been an ambassador. You, in all of your cabinet incarnations, you had some very interesting observations. And just looking through the book very briefly, because I hadn't had a chance to read it until you brought it in this morning, you describe quite emotively the situation in Thabo Mbeki's last cabinet meeting. Yeah. You go into how that felt. And many of us have tried to imagine what it would have been like in that room. Mm. And in the book, without giving too much away, because we want people to read it for themselves, what was the atmosphere like in that room at a moment where really history was being lived out by people like you?
Well, it was very somber. This question has been asked on quite a number of occasions. And unfortunately, I am still bound by the secrecy clauses of those positions. So I'm unable to talk about
the details
of a meeting like that. But it was, the atmosphere was very heavy and somber, as I say. And we did not also understand why the ANC was taking a decision like this. Because even at that time, we knew that we were going to have problems. And, of course, soon after that, COPE was born, taking away a number of our skilled politicians away from the ANC. And Thabo Mbeki only had six more years to, not years, months. He had 6 months. I mean, this was 2008, and there was going to be an election in 2009, within 6 months, and he would be gone. So we could not understand why the ANC was recalling Thabo Mbeki at that point. And unfortunately, you know, using also a decision, a court decision, which was discredited because there was then an appeal and that was set aside. That decision by Judge Nicholson was set aside. So the reason for the ANC's recall of Thabo Mbeki then
was a non-reason. It must be fascinating, and I hope that one day we will be able to sit and discuss these things without getting emotional about them, because they've affected all of us in positive and negative ways. There are people who've made enormous contributions who've gone unnoticed. In your book, you talk about a number of your comrades who really deserve a whole show on their own, just to give them some kind of decent eulogy for the contribution they've made. It's a fat book. It must have taken you a while to put all of this down in writing, even though you lived it and it's been burnt into your mind. Do you feel that there are things that you couldn't say when you wrote this book? Do you feel that there are things that you still wanted to say before you closed that last chapter?
Yes, there are some things, as I say, some of them, you know, relate to the secrets of government.
Yes.
That I could not write about. The others, at some stage, I felt that it would be a big book, and I did not want a big book. That book is big in any event. I mean, it runs into something like close to 400 pages. It's quite big. But I did not want to put everything in the book. And I suppose that if in the end we have another edition, maybe there are a few things that I'll...
Updates.
I'll put in there.
I do think that people will want to read the entire book, but it's worth reflecting on this, the last couple of sentences. Do you mind if I quote from the book?
Do that.
Zuma owes it to the founders of the ANC and the leaders who preceded him over many years to give the next president an opportunity to present him or herself in the highest office of the land and exert authority over everybody, thus leading the organization's forces and the other South Africans towards a new life, embracing the diverse phases of a higher complex existence, as Seme put it. What a great man that was. That is what the ANC calls for, a better life for all of South Africa's people, black and white. The ball is in the president's court. His conscience should tell him what to do, and, knowing him to be a revolutionary democrat, I am convinced he will do what is right. I believe he still possesses the right revolutionary orientation, and that this will make him understand that he must yield power in order to gain respect and save the movement he leads. Well, from your mouth to God's ears, Mr. Nqakula, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for talking to us this morning. And please send our regards to your wife. And obviously, we hope that her father is comfortable. And we hope that the family are all well. Thank you for spending some time, and thank you for this book.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed being here.
It's an absolute pleasure to have you. I hope we'll have you again when the update comes. and there will be much more to discuss. And please tell Minister Nosiviwe we'd love to have her in the studio too.
Thank you very much. I'm sure at the appropriate time she'll be available.
Certainly. Her part in the book is substantial. You know, her part in your life is substantial, and her part in our lives is substantial. Thank you so much. There we are. Charles Ngakula, the former minister, the former ambassador, a man who has led various organizations within the Alliance over many years, someone who has a hell of a story to tell. It's called The People's War. The book is available now and is worth a read. Reflections of an ANC Cadre. That is all we have time for this morning. We will see you tomorrow between 6 and 9. Thank you for joining us. And have a good day in the company of cliffcentral.com. Coming up next on Frankly Speaking, Dr. Makhosi Khoza, our special guest on Frankly Speaking with Andrew and Rory, next.
This is cliffcentral.com.